Hello, welcome to the JCBC podcast. My name is Sean King, and here during the season of Lent, I'm trying to provide you with a few messages that I've preached over the years during Lent that have enriched our lives as we make our way toward resurrection. This one was in 2014. It was entitled, Seven Deadly Sins. Hey, subscribe to us. Visit us online. We're at jcbc.org.
There is a great diner in Orlando where I would eat breakfast two or three times a week some days until Laura started seeing the receipts at the house. Then I had to scale it back a day or two. Loved it. It was called College Park Cafe. Just a little diner, kind of a mom and pop shop, right? But what I loved most is that every day, I mean every day, there was a group of men who met there, and I would watch them. They would gather in the middle of the room, gather a couple of the tables, scooch them together. Is that a word, Mike? Scooch? It works for you? That they would scooch the tables together, and then they would commence to, we call it a Baptist prayer meeting, I guess, which is a male gossip session, right? All right, just kind of shooting the breeze, chewing the fat, jawboning a little bit together, and they're great fun to watch. Most all of them were retired. And I knew that they went to the same church because one particular morning I found that they were discussing a Bible study that they were all a part of. And the Bible study was on the subject of lust. And the conversation that unfolded was really quite interesting. So one of the members of this group was a man they referred to themselves as Mr. Grayson. He was 93 years old. And one of the members of the youth group among them, one of the 65, 70-year-olds, said to Mr. Grayson, at what point in a man's life does lust no longer become a problem? And Mr. Grayson, without missing a beat, said, "You have to ask somebody older than me." It's a great moment, right? Great moment. And I just, it reminds me of the very first point I want to make right out of the chute. And here it is. You ready? Maybe the most respectful thing I can say about lust, the most respectful thing I can do for all of us in this room is to say this: lust is no respecter of persons. I mean, I don't care who you are. I don't care how young or how old you are. I don't care if you are male or female. Lust is no respecter of persons. Any one of us can be vulnerable, susceptible to having our imaginations lured into the shadows, to places where we assume no one will know. And surely, no one will be harmed by what goes on up here, right? None of us are immune. Lust is no respecter of persons. It could be a problem for any of us. I love what Genesis 4 talks about, that sin is crouching at the door, creeping, lurching at the door, waiting to see upon whom it may pounce. The same can be said about this of the seven deadly sins. Lust is no respecter of persons. But you know why I say that? One of the reasons why I suggest that lust is no respecter of persons is because you and I live in a sex-saturated society. I mean, everywhere you cannot hide from it. Our culture has changed. It has come to the place where at every turn, you know this, the best marketing out there, or we should say the most lucrative marketing out there, is sex-driven. Billboards, internet, it's everywhere you turn. In fact, so a couple years ago when the boys were younger than they are now, we were at the house and we're in Orlando and we're watching TV and there's this television show on, and it's just kind of a family-friendly show, pretty innocent, we're having a good time. I'm sitting on the couch, And my boys are on both sides of me. They kind of flanked me right there, right on the left. And we're watching the show. Laura's on the other, kind of the love seat there. We're watching. It goes to commercial. And the Victoria's Secret girls come on the TV, right? And I don't know what happened. Everything's kind of blurry at that point. And I must have been kind of gawking at the TV because I felt from the love seat this glaring, you know, piercing message, inaudible, but there it was. And I looked and Laura was just giving me the eye, you know. So I rolled my tongue back up off the floor, right, you know. And she looked at me as if to say, do something. So I did. I said, right? And I think I slept on the couch that night just to sin. And in this morning's conversation, lust is no respecter of persons because we live in a sin or a sex saturated society. It is everywhere you turn. In fact, can I just illustrate it a little bit more with some statistics for us, just for some facts to help kind of lay the groundwork. There is a ministry called Triple X Church. Have you heard of it? Triple X Church is a ministry designed to help rescue and help recover those who are addicted to pornography. And they have assembled from a half a dozen or more reputable research groups some stats that I think you may find a little, maybe more than interesting today. So while we assume that the majority of online pornography users are young men, we may be surprised that one in three women admit to viewing online porn. 12% of the websites on the internet are pornographic in nature. Do you know how much money is spent on internet pornography? $3,000 every second. That's 3,000, 6,000, 9,000. I can't count much higher than that, so I'll stop. Did you know that the percentage of men between 18 and 24 who view online pornography routinely, 70%? Did you know that one of the fastest growing people groups for whom online porn is an addiction, you know, the fastest growing addiction group? Senior adults. Did you know that one quarter, that's 25% of all browser searches, all searches on the internet, one fourth of them are pornographic in nature at some level? There are 116,000 searches for child pornography every day. The average age at which a child, listen up, first sees online porn, 11 years old. And it's usually in conjunction with doing homework, by the way. And we're not talking about the 1955 JCPenney underwear ad. We're talking about hardcore, graphic, demented, twisted images that cannot be erased from the mind. Did you know that 20% of men admit to watching porn at work? 13% of women admit to watching porn at work. The least popular day for watching internet porn, you know what it is? Least popular day of the year, sorry. The least popular day of the year? Thanksgiving. But think about why that may be. I mean, you got everything that you need for every other appetite. You got turkey. You got football. The house is full of people. And I'm only mildly being cheeky about this. I'm serious. Because at the heart of it, doesn't it have something to do with the appetites that we have? And so on that day, on Turkey Day, gobble, gobble, hashtag gobble, we have all of our appetites met. So it's the least popular. But do you know what the most popular day of the week is for online porn? Yeah, the Lord's Day. Did you know that 47% of Christian families admit to porn being a problem in their family? 47%. Now, The reason we're talking about this today is not just because it fits nicely in our seven-part series called Seven Deadly Sins, but we're talking about this candidly today because this is our problem. It's not their problem out there. It's our Christian family's problem when 47%, almost half of Christian families, struggle at some level with this, then we have to take the responsibility of addressing it a bit. So lust is no respecter of persons. Do you know what Frederick Buechner said about it? He said, lust is the ape that gibbers in our loins. Tame him as we will by day, he rages all the wilder in our dreams by night. Just when we think we're safe from him, he raises up his ugly head and smirks. And there's no river in the world that flows cold and strong enough to strike him down. Lust is no respecter of persons. But do you know why I think that is? Another reason, not just because we live in a sex-saturated society, but there's another reason. You know, in all of these seven deadly sins, we've been saying along the way that each of them, each sin is not just a sin in and of itself. In other words, wrath doesn't just exist, but it's a distortion of something else, right? Something good that has gone bad, right? We talked about pride, or we will be talking about pride, but we've talked about envy and greed, that these are not just in and of themselves sins, but all these seven deadly actually begin as something good that goes bad. So what is the good thing that has gone bad to become lust? I'm going to suggest today that it's desire. Desire. That's a good thing, desire. I want you to know that I think that we were designed for desire. I think that God made us capable of desire. We are hardwired. We are programmed to desire. There is something in us biologically that makes us able to notice someone that we think is attractive and be caught off guard, fumbling with our words, staggering a bit because how beautiful is she, is he? I think God has wired us that way. And even our friends who study us in biology say that we have a particular hormone for this. Did you know that? Oxytocin. Oxytocin is a hormone that gets released in our brains when we see somebody who looks attractive. It's as if God has programmed us to be capable, biologically, of noticing someone and saying, my, my. What a wonderful expression of God's creative capacity. How beautiful. Now, you may not know of oxytocin by its formal name, but you might have heard of its nickname. Have you ever heard of the cuddle hormone? That's right. It's known as the cuddle hormone. There's something in us that can be released in our brains when we see someone who is attractive, and I'll say it to Laura, Laura, I just want to cuddle. You're just looking so good. I just want to cuddle. You know, she doesn't buy it, right? But so go home and try that with your spouse today. Say, honey, my oxytocin levels are kind of surging. It's my hormone. I just want to cuddle, right? God makes us able to notice each other. And how beautiful is that? Not only is there biologically something within us that allows our species to continue, by the way, but theologically, there is a theological underpinning to this desire that is a good thing in us. In fact, Adam Hamilton points out that all throughout the biblical narrative, the divine narrative actually ends up punctuated with examples of God's own opinion, God's opinion about how good it is to be drawn to one another. For example, in the Eden story, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh, which in Hebrew is a Hebrew euphemism. It's an expression, it's a saying that suggests sexual intimacy and closeness. Or in the story about Abraham and Sarah, remember when the messengers came to Sarah and said, hey, you're gonna have a baby, and you're way past the age where that's normal, but you're gonna have a baby, and she laughs, and there's laughter about it, even names her son, Laughter, Yitzhak, right? And this is what she said. After I have become old and my husband is old, shall I still have pleasure? Or another translation says, shall we still see paradise? I love that, right? It's a Hebrew euphemism, a saying for sexual intimacy designed by God, intended for that healthy parameter of husband and wife. We even have a book in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, and the entire book is about this stuff, the Song of Solomon. In fact, the Song of Solomon is so steamy that young Hebrew boys in some traditions are not even allowed to read it until they become of age. No kidding. It's the story about two young lovers who are so intense with their interest and their passion with one another that they just cannot keep separate. And God points to that kind of story and says, it's with that intensity that I love you, my people. And all throughout the story, it's punctuated theologically with this reminder that desire is not something that starts out bad. It starts out as a God-given gift. But when desire is unchecked, when it is off course, when it twists itself and morphs into something different, when desire steps over the fences and begins to graze in a different kind of pasture, desire becomes lust. So how do you know when you've made that leap from natural desire that is good and normal and healthy and right to lust? Well, that conversation could take all day, right? But can I give you one simple example? Remembering that we have a wide range of ears listening to this conversation, right? We have those who are children, and we have those who are students, and we have Mr. Grayson, right? Can I give you one example? How can I check and see if my desire has leaped over into lust? Well, it's what I want to call the look or linger test. The look or linger test. Let's say you're driving down the road and you're on your way to the grocery store and someone comes jogging down the street. And you notice behind the wheel that this person takes fitness very seriously and is very attractive. And your oxytocin levels are beginning to, you know, on the radar screen. You notice and you look and you say, my, marvelous are thy works, O Lord. You know. From everlasting to everlasting, how great is our God, right? Let's say you notice and you look and you see there is nothing sinful about recognizing the beauty of another human being. Let's say you pull up and the light turns red. And you notice at the red light, well, he or she also has to kind of jog in place while they're waiting for the light to change. And you don't want to be a perv about it, so you don't really look at the person, right? But you kind of cut your eyes over, and you're looking, you're noticing, marvelous are thy works, O Lord. But then the light turns green, and you move forward. So far, it's only been a look. You've noticed. There's nothing wrong with noticing, right? The question is, when you pull away, do you adjust the rearview mirror? Because the moment that you adjust the rearview mirror to continue marveling at God's good handiwork, right, is the moment you might be stepping into the realm of lingering. When you go from a glance to a gaze, when you go from looking to lingering. And this is what I want you to remember. Lust is not about what you notice. Lust is about what you do with what you notice. Can I say it again? Lust is not about what you notice. Lust is about what you do with what you notice. Before he died, John Claypool told the story of two Buddhist monks who one day were walking along a stream and the rains came. It was a torrential downpour. And it was just flooding the area. And so this stream began to overflow its banks, and they noticed that there was a beautiful Japanese woman in a kimono waiting to cross over, but she couldn't because the water had surged too high. So one of the Buddhist monks goes up to the woman and asks, can I help you? And she obliges, yes, that would be great. He lifts her up on her shoulder, and he wades across the stream, and he puts her down safely and securely on the other side. The day goes on, and that night at supper, the monk who had stayed on the bank, on the shoreline, or on the other side of the stream, they were eating dinner, and he said to the one who had carried the woman, "Brother, I really have a bone to pick with you. I've got a problem with what happened today. You and I took vows to be monks. We took a vow to not even look upon a woman, much less speak to her or touch her. And you did all of that today. You carried her on your shoulder, and I just have a real problem with that. Don't you?" And the monk who had carried the woman said, "But brother, I put her down on the other side of the stream. You've been carrying her in your mind all day long." Yeah. It's not what you notice, it's what you do with what you notice. I think that may be something that Jesus was up to when he said it's all about, if you look upon a woman in a particular way, there's something destructive happening within, even when you can't see it, unless it goes checked. So lust is a distortion of desire. But not only is lust a distortion of desire, do you know what else that lust distorts? Lust also, and this is a big one, lust also distorts reality. Lust distorts reality. Richard Foster, the well-known writer and Quaker and author of the book Money, Power, and Sex, or Money, Sex, and Power, has these words to say about it. Listen to what he says. "The sex of the pornographic trade," and I love this quote. Hang with it for a minute. It's too slick. It's too wonderful. Too ecstatic. Sex in the real world is a mixture of tenderness and halitosis. Love and fatigue. Ecstasy and disappointment. When people believe the dream world, they begin to cast a disparaging eye at the flaws of the real world. Indeed, they begin to seek a flawless fantasy world. Such make-believe is genuinely destructive to both true sexuality and true spirituality. Man, that's strong, isn't it? And what he's saying is if you and I stay in this realm of lust where we create a kind of a fantasy world, and in that fantasy world, all the people are perfect, and they're all beautiful, and the sex is ecstatic, like he talks about. It's all this fantasy, and there's no imperfections whatsoever, and it's constantly this exhilarating experience, right? If we keep it up there, the truth is, if we constantly live there, then what that ends up doing is it ends up breaking the relationships, fracturing the health of the relationships that we have in the real world. Because whose spouse can keep up with that? I mean, no kidding. Who can keep up with the fantasy world? Because then, sooner or later, you begin to look at your real relationships and expect them to live on this high-octane, full-throttle image of imperfection and beauty as defined by an industry. It's Plato all over. It's Plato's allegory of the cave. Remember we talked about that, where there's this projection and a light behind a guy in the cave, and it shines a light up on the wall. It's really a shadow, but it's looking at the shadows projected on the wall and believing that the shadows are real. It's not the shadows, but it's what's causing the shadows. And what you and I do when we go with lust being unchecked is we look at the shadows, the images that are not real, and we say, well, now that ought to be the goal. And what we do is we buy into an illusion that fractures life, and that is what sin does. It fractures the relationship that we have with God and with each other and even with our own sense of soul and self. The truth is, as God designed it, as God describes it in the creational poems itself, there is something beautiful and wonderful. And in the context, in the fences of health, and the boundaries and parameters of God's holiness, There can be beauty and exhilaration and excitement and joy. But you know what else it's going to have to include? And I want our teenagers to know this. It's going to also include some embarrassment, some fumbling, and definitely some imperfections. You know why? That's what it means to be human. The trouble with lust is it lures us away from the reality of what it means to be human. So I'll say it a different way. Lust dehumanizes us. It not only dehumanizes the person that we're lusting over, but it dehumanizes the person who is doing the lusting. Because at the heart of this, remember, is a desire that God put there. And that desire was painted beautifully in the Garden of Eden. And there's this beautiful image of the first people in complete union with each other. And there's transparency and vulnerability and joy. We hear things like, and he walked with God in the cool of the day. And there's this sense of beauty and connectedness. And we watch between the first woman and the first man. And there's a kind of shared flesh, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, right? And there's this phrase that gets read in chapter 2. The man and wife were both naked and were not ashamed. Can we think about that phrase for just a moment? Naked and not ashamed. The way God paints that picture in Genesis 2 is that there is a man and a woman who are vulnerable and transparent with nothing to hide, and they're not even aware that they are not perfect. Because they have no one to compare themselves to. The trouble with lust is that it puts you in a state of constant comparison to images that are not even real. And so in the Eden Garden, the picture itself, we get an image of this is what God intends in our humanity, that there is safety in one another. We view one another as an extension of our own stuff, the substance with which we are made, you are made. But the problem with lust is it stops seeing the other as being a human sharing the same substance, made of the same thing. Instead, lust begins to make us see the other human not as equals, imperfect as we, but we begin to see the other as something to be consumed, as somebody who's been put here just for my pleasure, just for my consumption, just for my enjoyment and entertainment. It dehumanizes. And isn't that what a consumer society does? You and I turn people into products, and we assume that everyone else around us is here for our consumption, and we devour them for our own pleasure. It dehumanizes. Maybe the best illustration that I've heard in recent days has been about the legendary way in which an Eskimo hunts for a wolf. It's said that when an Eskimo would hunt for a wolf, they would take a knife and they would cover it in blood and let it freeze. But then after it froze at the end of the blade, they would freeze some more blood on top of it. Let it freeze. And coat it with another layer of blood and let it freeze until there are 3, 4, 5 layers of blood and ice, kind of a blood popsicle, right? And then they would take the knife and put it upside down in the snow. And overnight, from miles away, the wolf with its keen sense of smell would detect the blood and follow it until it found the knife. And would begin to lick the first layer of the frozen blood and becoming intoxicated by the taste, wanting more and more and more. It would continue to lap up the frozen blood until it began to feverishly lap more and more, more vigorously, and to the point that his enjoyment, the wolf's enjoyment, wouldn't stop there. He needed more and more until eventually, with his tongue as numb as it would be, could not know when it was beginning to now lap itself upon the blade. And the cold blood, he didn't even notice, had turned to warm. And in the morning, the Eskimo would find the wolf dead. having devoured his own blood enough to where it consumed him. And that is the parable. There is no amount of lust that can satisfy. Well, that's what lust does. It's insatiable. It causes us to think that there is more. Perhaps I can get more. And you constantly are not satisfied until you seek more and you pursue more. I love what Richard Exley says about it. Richard Exley says, lust is not the result of an overactive sex drive. It's not the biological phenomenon or the byproduct of our glands. If it were, then it could be satisfied with a sexual experience, like a glass of water quenches thirst, or a good meal satisfies an appetite. But the more we attempt to appease our lust, the more demanding it becomes. There is simply not enough erotica in the world to satisfy lust's insatiable appetite. So what do we do? What do you do when you come to the place when you recognize I may be walking into this so far that I can't get back out? Maybe you listen to what James had to say. James says in his first chapter, but one is tempted by one's own desire, being lured and enticed by it. Then, when that desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when that sin is fully grown, gives birth to death. Do not be deceived, my beloved. I love the imagery there. James says, yeah, there's desire, but gone unchecked, that desire can grow up and get pregnant, and it gives birth, and the thing that births out of desire can sometimes be sin, and sin grows up, gets pregnant, and sin gives birth to death. So the grandchild of desire is death. What do you do when you recognize that's the trajectory you've been on? Well, I think we take some cues from our Hebrew forebears. Do you know they have a word for repentance? The Hebrew word for repentance is shuv. Shuv is interesting to me because it literally is translated turn back. Here's the image. You've been moving one way, one trajectory, one path in your life, and you recognize, you come to a place where you stop. And you look ahead and you recognize the place where I'm going is my own destruction. I don't know how I got here. It's been a long time since I've been anywhere healthy, but here I am. And I know that every time I get to this place, I look back and wish I had never taken a turn there or a turn there, but here I am. And I know it's killing me. It's taken life out of me. But shuv says, when you come to the place where you recognize that, and you regret that, you say to the Lord, I'm lost. I don't know how I got here, but I'm here. And I know if I continue down this path, it will lead to my destruction. Forgive me. For whatever it took to get me where I am, forgive me. And then the second part of shuv is this. You turn and you go a different direction. I want you to listen to the words of Romans chapter 12. Listen to what is said here, chapter 2. Don't you see how wonderfully kind, tolerant, and patient God is with you? Does this mean nothing to you? Can't you see that his kindness is intended to turn you from your sin? The truth is, and here's the good news I want you to hear loud and clear. We're headed to Easter, right? We're in the season of Lent, but Lent means that Easter is on the way. That means resurrection is coming, and we will be reminded that all sin is forgiven and new life is available. But the truth is, God's desire is not just to stop you in your tracks from going any further. That's only the first part. God desires to stop you, or for you to stop. But God desires not just to cleanse you from what you have done wrong, but God desires to help you, empower you to turn around so that your next steps are life-giving and not life-taking. And so today, I wonder if it's possible that somewhere in here there is someone who needs to come to the place where you stop where you are and you recognize in the privacy of your own relationship with Christ, I need help stopping where I am and turning to walk in a new direction. And I'm here to tell you that the power of Christ's love for you is stronger than any power that tends to lure you into the shadows. What we've been saying all along is that Jesus meets you where you are, but loves you too much to leave you there. I wonder if today somebody needs to surrender and come to a place of yieldedness where you allow the power of Christ to pull you into a life-giving direction.